There are so many new buildings in the East End. It's as if everything that made it ours is gone, Emmy. St. Paul's is there, of course, but nothing else that I can remember. When that search proved useless, we went looking for Mum's grave. She was buried in a plot of earth with 100 other paupers on September 12, 1940. They didn't know what date to put for her date of birth, Emmy. It just says her name and the date she died. The day after you and I came back to London. Do you know she's dead, Emmy? If I were to see you again, this would be hard for me to say, to tell you she's dead. She was in the basement of a hotel that night. A bomb obliterated the building and sent it in pieces hurtling onto the basement, crushing the 20 or so other people who were sheltered there when the air raid started. I don't know why she was there. The tiny headstone doesn't say that. Granny said maybe she had been outside on the sidewalk and ran into the shelter when the sirens began to wail. Granny didn't tell me right away that Mum had been killed, because she was afraid I would disappear into myself and never emerge again. Neither did she tell me that Neville had died before Mum did, even before you and I were evacuated. It's true. He was gone before we left London for Aunt Charlotte's. Mum didn't tell me, though. And Mum didn't tell me I had grandparents either, which I still don't understand. Granny had offered to take us, Emmy, before we went to Charlotte's. She wrote to Mum after Neville died and told her she would take us away from the war. We could have come together to America, you and I. Well, she didn't exactly offer to take you in that letter she wrote, because she didn't know about you. But a long time later, she told me if she had known I had an older sister, she would have offered to take us both to America. But Mum didn't tell me Granny had written to her. I was at Aunt Charlotte's, thinking Neville was still in India when he was already dead. And we spent all those weeks away, and I never knew I had grandparents who wanted to see me. When I asked Granny why Mum did that, she said I shouldn't ponder things I could only guess about. She said maybe Mum needed time to get used to the idea that I even had grandparents, and that Neville was dead, and that before she got used to either one, the Germans started bombing London. Why didn't Neville tell me I had grandparents? Granny said she had to do the same thing as me, not ponder too hard things she could only guess about. She told me my grandfather and Neville didn't see eye to eye in anything. Gramps wanted Neville to go to Oxford and get a proper education, settle down, and have a respectable career. Neville didn't want any of that. He wanted to be in theatre. So maybe he didn't tell them he had a daughter, because he knew he hadn't become a father in the proper way, and he figured that would matter to Gramps. I think Neville might have also wanted to keep me from his parents, because he was afraid if I was around them, I would grow to be like them, unimpressed with who he was. I didn't come to this conclusion until I was much older, because even though Granny told me not to ponder it, I did. I pondered a lot of things. You're probably wondering how I came to be with Granny. First, you need to know that Neville was in a horrific car accident in Dublin. That's where he was, Emmy, not India. He was living with a woman who owned a little theatre. He was starting to direct plays and skits, and he was out one night, after a performance that he had starred in and directed. He'd had too much to drink, and he crashed the car he was driving into another car. The crash didn't kill him, but he was so badly hurt, and he barely had any money for the hospital. No surprise there, right? The woman he was living with was afraid he would die if he didn't get the medical care he needed, so she looked up his parents and rang them. Gramps and Granny came out to see if they could transfer him to a hospital in Oxford, but his injuries were too severe. Right before he died, Neville told his parents about me, told them where I lived, and what Mum's name was. Granny said it was as if he knew he was dying, and he wanted to give them something precious and beautiful in place of all the heartache. And that's just what he did, Granny said. She told me all of this before I was talking again, probably sometime in the second year we were in Connecticut. I remember I had already had my 8th birthday. I still didn't know about Mum, and I didn't know where you were. I've never known where you were. It hurt to hear Neville had died long before, and worse still, to be told a few weeks later that Mum was also dead, and had been dead for months and months. Both times I felt myself folding in, like I was spinning a cocoon. Granny knew what happened to Mum, because Gramps discovered it and told her. Granny never really had Mum's permission to take me to America, but it wasn't like she could wait around to get it, with the Germans bombing London every 5 minutes, and Mum nowhere in sight. But I guess Gramps had been insisting all along that they had to find out where Mum had disappeared to. Gramps didn't feel right about Granny whisking me off without Mum's permission, even though I was now far from the war. Granny finally gave in and told him to see what he could find, though I know now that she was terribly afraid Mum was in turn looking for me and would want me back. Gramps hired someone to look for Mum, and that person found out Mum had died in the bombings. Her name was on a list. When Granny finally told me Mum was in heaven, I said 3 words. The first in who knows how long. "What about Emmy?" And Granny said, "Who is Emmy?"
"My sister,"
I said. "A sister? Was she Neville's daughter too?" Granny asked, and she looked like she was about to have a heart attack, thinking Neville had 2 little girls in London, and she had rescued only one of them. I shook my head. "From another daddy?" Granny asked, and I nodded. "I don't know where she is," Granny said, "but I can try to find her. Would you like me to?" I was done with words for another few years. I just nodded my head. But Granny never did find you. Sometimes I wonder how hard she looked. And I know it wasn't easy during the war to find out where someone was. And then sometimes I wonder if she did find out, and she just couldn't tell me. Even now, when I could ask her, should ask her, I can't. I have done my own searching. I've looked in every telephone directory I can find for an Emmeline Downtree. In my braver moments, I've checked cemeteries and fatality reports from the war. I've even checked every bridal magazine, every design house, every wedding dress shop in London, and it's because I can't find you in that little universe that I fear you must be dead. If I could have one wish, it would be that I hadn't switched out the bride's box with my fairy tale book that night we left Aunt Charlotte's. I would, Emmy, even if it meant it was the only wish I could have. I've looked for your brides everywhere. Every time I see a woman in a wedding dress, I look to see if she is wearing one of your gowns. But how could she? You don't have any of your designs. I took them from you. I'm so desperately sorry, Emmy. If I could remember Aunt Charlotte's last name, or the house where she lived, or the town where the house was, I would see if the bride's box was still there, and I would spend the rest of my life looking for you, so that I could give it back to you. But I can't remember where that house was, or Charlotte's last name. When I tried to find out, I learned that the building where the East End evacuation records were kept was destroyed by a V-1 flying bomb in 1944. I can't make it right. I wish I could take back what I did. I wish it all the time. This is not helping me. This is not helping. Julia. Chapter 35. June 12, 1958. Dear Emmy, I told Dr. Diamond today that the journal idea is not working. She wanted to know why. I told her but I didn't feel better after writing to you. I actually felt worse. She said sometimes, on the road to healing, you must reopen an old wound. It will hurt again, maybe as much as, or more than it did when it was first inflicted. but as you reconnect with and embrace the healing process, it will begin to hurt less. Sometimes a broken bone does not heal properly, and there is unrelenting pain because bones that aren't supposed to touch are rubbing up against each other. The only way to fix it is to break the bone again and reset it. That's the only way it can heal properly. You have to break the bone again. That was her way of explaining that as I write to you, I might feel worse before I feel better. I suppose that makes sense. But I didn't know what else to say to you. Dr. Diamon asked if I would feel okay if she read what I had written so far. I let her read it. Dr. Diamon said she was very proud of me for being so honest with you, and that I should keep going. Keep going how? I said. She suggested that I start at the beginning, where you and I left off, because if I were to see you again, that's what I would want to hear from you. I'd want to know what happened to you after we were parted. I admit I'm afraid to go back to that day, Emmy. I've placed it so far in the back of my mind. I worry that by dragging it up from that dark place where it's been sleeping, I will relive it. And if I relive it, then I will again become that silent girl who can't sleep at night. Dr. Diamon told me that little girl has grown up. I can speak to that 7-year-old inside me and tell her she survived this. I don't need to be afraid of looking back to the place where she was, because that place is just a memory, and memories have no power but what I allow them. I will try very hard to keep that in mind as I write. Simon is sitting here next to me. He doesn't know everything about what happened the day my life changed, but he knows how hard this is for me. I told him I would let him read this journal when I am done, so that he will know what he is dealing with. That seems only fair. In the meantime, we are sitting side by side at my kitchen table, with only a teapot between us. He is reading while I write these words to you, and every so often, he gently rubs my back and refills my teacup. So here we go. Back to the beginning. I awoke to the sound of sirens. At first, I thought you had not left the flat, because it seemed you had only just been at my side a second earlier, fluffing the sofa pillows and telling me to stay where I was and that Mum would be home soon. I called for you as the sirens wailed, but you did not answer. I heard popping sounds, the far-off echoes of the anti-aircraft guns, and thundering booms that seemed to come from up underneath the earth. You did not tell me what to do if the sirens went off, so I stayed on the sofa and covered my ears with the throw pillows. I screamed for you, and for Mum, even though I knew I was alone. Then I heard the whistles of the bombs, some far away and some near, and I began to hear the explosions as they landed, despite the pillows over my ears. I felt them in my chest, in the very depths of me. This wasn't a drill. This was real. The Germans were bombing London. Instinctively, I knew I should run for cover, but you told me to stay in the flat. Mum was coming. I scrambled to the corner with the sofa pillows and crouched there. I remember crying and how my wail sounded like the sirens outside. But then a bright flash, and a thunderous whack shook the flat. The front window shattered. Confetti-like glass blew into the room and fell on my hair and in my lap, everywhere. I screamed for you. I screamed for Mum. I tossed the pillows and sprang for the front door. When I opened it, I could see that the row of flats across the street was wrapped in a fog of powdered debris. A gaping hole stretched across where front doors and upper floors had been. The air was thick with smoke and fire, and the buzzing of giant insects, which were the planes that I could not see. It was as if I had been transported to hell. All I could do was stand there and scream for you. Then there were arms around me. I heard a voice say my name. At first I thought it was an angel, come to pluck me out of hell. And then I thought it was you, Emmy, waking me from a nightmare. I fell into those arms, and I felt myself being lifted. I opened my eyes to tell you I was afraid, and I saw that I was not dreaming. You were not holding me there on the sofa, while I pulled myself out of a tormented sleep. I was in Thea's arms.
"Where's your mum? Where's Emmy?"
she shouted as she carried me toward her house. I could not answer her. A boom split the air as another bomb fell not far away. Thea stumbled and then caught her balance against the doorframe. She dashed with me through her front room, and I remember all of her furniture was covered in white sheets. Then we were on her back step, and I saw what Thea had been up to when the sirens went off. Her two cats and the four kittens, much larger now than they had been when we left for the countryside, were laid out on her back steps. They were so strangely still in the midst of all that chaos. I knew they were dead. She had gassed them with ether, Emmy, so that they wouldn't starve on the streets as she and her mother evacuated to a relative's home in Wales. I didn't know that many London pet owners euthanized beloved pets that they couldn't take with them when they fled the city. Thea and her mother were leaving London the next day. Her mother was already at a hotel near Paddington Station. Thea had come back to the flat to take care of the cats so that her mother wouldn't have to see. She had just finished her dreadful chore when the sirens began to scream, and so did I. I learned all this from Granny much later. All I knew then, as Thea ran with me to her Andy, was that the kittens I had loved and played with and called special names were dead. It was dark and clammy inside the shelter. Every time a bomb shook the earth, the Andy's walls rumbled. Thea held me in her arms on a cot on the floor, rocking me back and forth while she sang Christmas carols. I don't know why she did that. Granny said later it was because she didn't have to concentrate on the words. They were just right there. Or maybe it was because Christmas carols made us think of presents, Father Christmas, peppermint, and baby Jesus. Things that make us feel safe and loved and happy. I don't know how long the raid lasted. I just remember there being a moment when the bombs stopped and the booms outside were replaced with the wail of emergency response vehicles. When we crawled out of the shelter, we saw that the world around us had become colorless, except for the orange hue of hundreds of fires. Ash and dust swirled. Thea steered me past the cats. Their lifeless bodies were peppered with bits of roofing tile. She led me back to our flat, calling Mum's name.
Annie!
Julia, did your mum bring you back here from Gloucestershire? She asked as we stood in the living room. I shook my head no.
How did you get back, sweetie? Did Emmy come with you?
I had no voice to tell her.
What are your foster parents' names? Do you know where they live?
I thought of the idyllic world we had just left hours before, where everything was perfect, except that Mum wasn't there. I wanted to go back. I wanted to go back in time to that happy place before you left me, before the bombs came, before the dead cats.
Charlotte, I said.
It was the only word I said for a long time.
Charlotte?
Thea said.
What's her last name?
I couldn't remember.
Sweetheart, where does Charlotte live?
I couldn't remember where she lived, Emmy. I still can't. Thea took me by the hand into the kitchen.
Did you and Emmy write to your mum? She asked.
I might have nodded as Thea looked through Mum's recent mail for a letter from us.
Does your mum keep important papers in a special place? Do you know where she'd put your billeting card?
I said nothing. A blanket of numbness was replacing the fear. We went upstairs, crunching on glass that had been blown onto the steps. Thea went into Mum's bedroom and opened her top bureau drawer. She looked inside and pulled out an envelope. Granny told me much later that Thea had thought she'd found a letter from us because she didn't recognize the return address. but it wasn't a letter from you and me. It was the letter Granny had written to Mum after Neville died. Thea read it while I leaned against her leg. That was how I came to be with Gramps and Granny, Emmy. Thea couldn't find our billeting papers that had Charlotte's name and address. She didn't know where Mum was. She didn't know where you were. And she was leaving for Wales the next day. Thea took the letter, and we left our demolished neighborhood. We had to walk a little bit before she was able to hail a taxi that could take us to her hotel. The air raid siren started again as we were getting out of the taxi cab. I think we spent the night in the hotel basement. That part is a bit foggy. In the morning, Thea called Gramps and Granny. They talked for a little while, Thea in hushed tones. Then she called the widow Mum worked for, and I heard her ask if she could please try to get word to Mum that I would be at my grandparents' house. The next thing I remember, I was on a train with Thea and her mother. They took me to the Oxford railway station on their way to Wales, and Gramps and Granny met us there. I recall Thea telling Granny that Mum worked for a widow named Mrs. Billingsley, whom Thea had called that morning. The widow's butler would try to locate Mum and let her know where I was. When Thea knelt to say goodbye, I flung my arms around her neck and held tight. "Your grandparents will take good care of you," she said. "They are your family, Julia. They will help you find your Mum." I tightened my grip around Thea's neck. She had to pry me loose. I crumpled to the pavement as Thea, crying into her handkerchief, walked away. Gramps lifted me into his arms. I really don't remember anything else of that day. Just Thea, the last link I had to the life I knew, growing smaller and smaller in my field of vision, until she was gone. My hand hurts, Emmy. Everything hurts. I must stop for now. Chapter 36. June 18th, 1958. Dear Emmy, I had to take a few days off from the journal. Spilling everything about the bombing like that sort of took the breath right out of my lungs. I've been in a bit of a mental wasteland for the last few days. Trouble concentrating at work, not sleeping well, things like that. Dr. Diamond told me this might happen, and not to worry. It's perfectly normal to need some time to sort out these memories that I'm dredging up. That hasn't stopped Simon from worrying, unfortunately. He called Dr. Diamond and said that maybe this wasn't such a good idea after all. I don't know what Dr. Diamond told him, but Simon said, "All right, all right, all right," three times. Somehow she convinced him this was still a good idea. And so I am back. It's 2 a.m. I can't sleep, so I may as well write to you. It's hard to fully recall those first few days with Gramps and Granny. It's almost as if there are rooms in my mind where all these memories are kept, and some of those rooms have no doors. I know the memories are there, but I've no way of getting to them. When Granny called Mrs. Billingsley on Monday, 2 days after the bombing, she was told Mum hadn't shown up for work that day. Mrs. Billingsley had sent her butler to our flat to make sure Mum was all right, but he'd found our street bombed and our flat empty. All of the flats on our side were empty. He found no one to even ask if they'd seen her. The butler had taken it upon himself to check with the hospital, but there was no record of an Annie Downtree having been admitted. Gramps and Granny were worried about me, because I wouldn't speak. The only time they heard my voice was when I screamed in my sleep. Granny told Gramps she wanted to take me to America to get me away from the war. Other family members of Oxford instructors had been evacuated to Connecticut under a private scheme to the homes of Yale professors and staff members. Granny begged Gramps to see if she and I could go, even though everyone else had already left many weeks before. Gramps didn't like the idea because of the U-boats patrolling the Atlantic. One ship full of evacuees, mostly children, had already been torpedoed. But Granny insisted. She had to get me away from the war, or she'd lose me like she lost Neville, just in a different way. I heard her say this. We were at the docks at Liverpool just 2 days later, boarding a ship that would take me away from England for nearly 5 years. I don't think Granny had any idea that's how long we would be away. I don't think anyone knew the war would last that long. On the passenger manifest, I was listed as Julia Waverley. Granny said my father would want me to have his last name, since he had been taken from me so early in my life. I didn't want a new last name, but I was unable to argue that point. By the time I was able to speak my mind, I had been a Waverley for almost as long as I had been a Downtree, and it didn't seem to matter as much. Being a Downtree would not bring you back. I have been Julia Waverley ever since. What I remember of the crossing is the swaying of the ship, like a cradle being rocked. But I also remember there being alarms, and donning our life vests, as U-boats were in the area, and at any moment they might close in on us and blow our ship to bits. I remember Granny having to cram my arms through the vest as I fought and kicked. I also remember her pacing the floor by my cot in our stateroom. I can still see her shoes going back and forth. Just her shoes, because I am under the cot. I remember dreaming that it's not dead cats I see on Thea's back steps. It is you and Mum and Neville. The first few weeks after we arrived are a blur. Less than a blur. Those memories are in one of the rooms with no door. I think it's odd that I can remember the smell of acrid smoke, the feel of broken glass under my shoes, and the open-eyed stares of those cats. But I can't remember the first weeks of my life in tranquil America. There was no war there, no sandbags, or barrage balloons, or running for cover. We lived on the third floor of a brick colonial, situated on a peaceful tree-lined street, with a Yale professor of history, Dr. Bauer, and his wife Florence. Their twin sons, Charlie and Randall, were in the United States Army Air Corps, training to be pilots. Granny had the bigger of the two rooms, furnished with a lovely canopied bed, but she often slept in the armchair in my room. At least for a while she did. My room reminded me of the room you and I shared at Aunt Charlotte's. It was nestled in the corner, with a slanted roof that I could touch where it met the wall. After I had settled in, I would lie in my bed, close my eyes, and imagine that I was back at Aunt Charlotte's, and you were just a few feet away. This was how I fell asleep every night for many, many nights, imagining you were in a bed next to me, and that we were safe at Charlotte's. The bride's box on the nightstand between us, along with my book of fairy tales. While the rest of that September, and then October, and November are lost to me, I do remember my first Christmas in America. Snow covered the ground, light shone in every window, and there were presents under a lovely tree. Florence made gingerbread men, and decorated them with frosting faces and buttons. We drank hot chocolate, while Professor Bauer read from the Bible by a snapping, happy fire. The professor and his wife didn't listen to the radio, at least not when I was in the vicinity. So there were no reports of doom telling us how terrible it was in Europe. School had been let out. I don't recall much of my first months of school, I'm afraid, and Granny bought me a plaid wool coat and a matching tam with a pom-pom on top, so that we could go for twilight walks under violet skies. I remember feeling a sense of tranquility for the first time in weeks and weeks. But when I heard carolers outside my window, I was back under my bed again, while Granny paced the floor of that pretty little room, begging me to come out. She didn't find out for a long while why I couldn't handle hearing Christmas carols. In some ways I still can't. When I hear them now, at Christmas time, I want to think only happy thoughts. But a niggling tug won't let me forget Thea singing carols in her bomb shelter, as she held me tight, and hell fell down all around us. There was a terrible night of bombing in London that same Christmas, worse than the day you were taken from me, but I didn't hear about it until later. Newspapers never made it home to the Bower House. The professor read them at the college and left them there. I think I started to see that first troll of a doctor right after Christmas. I had begun to say a few words here and there, mostly no and I don't want to. Florence had a cute little spaniel named Pixie that I liked to play with, and I would talk to her, but never more than a few sentences, and I always stopped when the adults froze like statues to listen to me. I knew if I started talking in full sentences to them, they'd start asking me questions. So to Dr. Nielsen I went. I suppose he tried all the tricks he knew with me, but I didn't trust him any. I didn't believe that by telling him anything, he could reverse time. And you and I could go back to that day at Aunt Charlotte's, when I found those notes you wrote. If I could have lived that moment over again, I would have told Charlotte what you were planning to do. I would have run down the stairs and shown her those notes. And yes, you would have been hopping mad at me. Maybe for quite a while. But then you would have softened, as you always did. You would have forgiven me for tattling on you. And then you and I would have spent those 5 years of the war together at Aunt Charlotte's. You would have continued to draw your lovely dresses. We would have celebrated our birthdays and Christmases without me under the bed. Mum would have come to visit us now and then. And when the war was over, we would have gone back to London. We'd be together. And I would not have needed to count things to keep from going mad. You would have gotten your job back at that bridal shop you loved. I've looked for that shop too, but have not been able to find it. And you would have made your wedding gowns, and they'd be in the window just like all those other dresses had been, except yours would be more beautiful, and I would have said, "I told you so." Could Dr. Nielsen have made that happen? No, he could not. He wanted me to talk about the horrible things that had taken place, and which he could not change. What was the point of that? I suppose Granny kept dragging me to him, because he kept saying it might take time. By the end of May, she figured out he wasn't going to be the one to help me. School was about to be dismissed, and she wanted me to enjoy a happy summer, even if it meant a silent one. I was actually sad to see the school term end. Even though my teacher could barely get a word out of me, I did well in school. Learning was my place of escape. Not school itself, but the activity of learning. It gave my brain something to do that was unrelated to the war and my losses. When Dr. Troll suggested perhaps Granny needed to consider institutionalizing me, she showed him my report card and said, so she told me, that what I needed was a break from doctors like him. We spent the summer at a cabin the Bowers owned, somewhere on a lake. I don't remember what the lake was called. It was very beautiful there, Emmy. There was a girl in the cabin next to ours, named Franny, who was a year younger than I was, and in Granny's words, a relentless chatterbox. Franny probably loved that I said practically nothing when we played together, because that allowed her to fill every silent moment with her ceaseless prattle. I felt very much at ease with Franny. She did all the talking, and never hungered for me to say anything in return. Some days I very nearly forgot why I was there. Amazingly enough, whole days passed when I didn't think of you and ache for a time machine. Every summer we'd go back to the cabin on the lake, and every year Franny would be waiting for me. The last time we went was the summer of 1944. I was 11. Franny wasn't there when we arrived. She came a few weeks into July, and she was different. Quieter. More like me. One morning, just after she and her parents arrived, we went out on the lake in her little rowboat. She had never asked me much about my life to that point. I figured Granny and Franny's mother had talked, and Franny had been apprised that I was a British girl who had fled the war in Europe. But that day, she asked me if I knew what the war was like. I nodded. "Is it terrible?" she asked. Again, I nodded. Then she told me her parents had been sent a telegram. Her brother was missing in action, somewhere in France. His plane had been shot down.
"Do you think he's afraid?"
Franny asked. I thought about it for a moment, and slowly nodded my head. "Just because you're an adult doesn't mean you're not afraid." I'd seen fear in Granny's eyes.
"Do you think he's okay?"
She wanted what I wanted. To know that her brother was alive somewhere, and would come back to her. I spoke to her. Just one word.
"Maybe."
She was no doubt surprised to hear my voice, but that I had offered a ray of hope was the biggest surprise. The girl who knew what war was like was telling her not to give up hope. Sometimes I wonder if that's what the journal is supposed to show me, Emmy. Perhaps it is so I can know if it is possible to hold on to hope and still move on. Is that possible? I don't know. I am tired now. Good night, Emmy. Julia.
Chapter 37. June 22nd, 1958. Dear Emmy, Simon and I are going to the ballet this afternoon, Swan Lake. He has a cousin who is dancing in it. After the performance, there will be a party at his aunt and uncle's house in Chelsea. I have met only his mother and father. Tonight I will meet everyone else. His brother Dennis and his wife Trudy. His grandparents, both sets. 4 sets of aunts and uncles, and 12 or more cousins. I'm a little nervous about it. I never know what to say when people ask about my family. Maybe they won't ask tonight. Maybe Simon has told them everything already, and I can avoid having to explain it 10 times over. Except that if they all know, then I will be subject to the pathetic stares. When you're known as the young woman orphaned by the war, and tragically separated from your only sister, you can't help but be rewarded with pathetic stares. No one really knows what to say to you, but they think hard to come up with something, and as they are blistering their brains to find the right words, they stare. They don't mean to, but they do. Simon will watch over me, thank goodness. I doubt he will leave my side for a second. He's afraid I will get scared off, and he'll have to go back to the beginning and woo me all over again. Did I tell you what he does for a living? He's an accountant for the company I work for. Our company makes maps and globes and atlases. I love working there. I love the idea that it's important to know there are many places other than the one where you are. I'm an assistant to the art director. It's not like I'm good at art, not like you. But I am good at maintaining the research files and working with the surveyors and artists. I keep everyone in line, my boss likes to say. He told me he's never met anyone who can keep track of all the details like I can. I think it's because during the war, when I was forced to reinvent myself as Julia Waverley, I was highly aware of the details of my new life. I knew how many steps it was to the 3rd floor of the Bowers house. I knew how many tiles there were on the bathroom floor. I knew how many knobs were on the kitchen cabinets, and how many books Professor Bower had in his study. I had counted all these things. Counting things was how I kept hold of my new life, since it was all I had that I could control. When I would think of you and Mum, and the flat, and the kittens, and home, I would have to start counting something to keep myself from going crazy. Sometimes Granny would hear me whispering the numbers, and she'd pretend that she hadn't. One of the doctors she took me to told her it was my way of coping with what had happened, and not to pester me about it. I think it worried her, though. Counting the rosebuds on the rug in the living room, or slats in the blinds, surely seemed pointless to her. I no longer count to keep myself calm, but when I do count something,
like presentation folders at work. It reminds me of how scared I was to come back to London when the war was over. Granny and I returned to England in June 1945. I was 12, but it was another 4 years before I saw London again. Just as in America, school here in England wasn't hard for me, but socially I was an outcast. Those of us evacuees who spent the war years in America were treated differently from those who had spent the war years in the English countryside, mostly because of our Yank accents, but also because it was believed we had not suffered like those who had stayed had. My teen years weren't the greatest. I am ashamed to tell you, there were times when I wondered how much rope I would need and if it would hurt very much. I didn't see a psychologist for the first couple of years we were back, but Granny sensed I was having a rough go of it, so she found one for me. Dr. Bristol was 30-something and handsome. I remember looking forward to Tuesday afternoons when I would see him. He coaxed out of me a lot of what I have shared with you here. He's the one who said I needed to visit London again, even if just for a few hours, so that I wouldn't be afraid of it anymore. He even offered to come with Granny and me, which I was all for, but Granny said she could handle it. Granny decided we'd go for tea at Harrods, just for tea. Harrods wasn't near Whitechapel or St. Paul's, so I wouldn't have to see anything I didn't want to see, unless we started strolling east. Did you know, Emmy, that fear can feel like heaviness? I am sure you probably do. The whole time we were on the train, I seemed to be carrying the weight of those 9 years I had been away from London. It was as if time itself were a tangible thing, that one could put on a scale and then watch the needle swing right. When we closed in on Paddington Station, I looked for something in our car to count. I could find nothing, so I closed my eyes and counted seconds. The train stopped and everyone stood up to be on their way. Granny waited until I stood before she rose as well. She silently took my hand, and we got off. I counted hats on heads as we walked through the station and out to the queue of taxis waiting at the curb. Inside the cab, with Granny still holding my hand, I counted buses and bicycles and black cars as we made our way to Knightsbridge, a couple miles away. By the time we stepped out of the cab a few minutes later, I had slowed to counting just my own breaths, slow and even. Fear is worse than pain, I think. Pain is centralized, identifiable, and wanes as you wait. Fear is a heaviness you can't wriggle out from under. You must simply find the will to stand with it and start walking. Fear does not start to fade until you take the step that you think you can't. I got out of the cab onto the street, and I stood there balancing the weight of nearly a decade of regret. Granny somehow knew just to stand still next to me after she'd paid the driver. After a moment, I knew I could walk and carry it, because you would have wanted me to. We had tea, and Granny found things to talk about that had nothing to do with anything important. We were just like any other young woman and her grandmother out for an afternoon of shopping. I sat in my chair and drank from my cup as one in a near dream state. Fear is not only a leaden foe, but a liar as well. It was not as bad as I thought it would be, sitting there in a London department store on an ordinary Saturday. We walked to the underground to take the train back to Paddington. There was a terrible moment when we walked past a bridal shop, and I was reminded of what I had stolen from you. I'm sure you know I hid the bride's box in the crawl space in our bedroom at Aunt Charlotte's. When you went to get me a drink of water, I stuck it on a ledge that is over the frame of the little door. You can only see it from the inside. I am so sorry, Emmy. I wish you could know how sorry I am. Dr. Bristol was immensely proud of me when I saw him the following week and told him about the trip. He said I had crossed a bridge, a big one. And now that I had crossed it, I could take more trips to London, which Granny and I did over the next couple of years. We even went to a church service at St. Paul's, so that I could stand just a stone's throw from where you and I lived and not be undone by it. I stopped seeing Dr. Bristol just before I turned 18, at his advice, since he was a child psychologist, and I was certainly no longer a child. I also came to realize he was married, and a new father, so the attraction I'd had for him had started to diminish. He was very happy with my progress. I was talking, counting only when something truly needed to be counted, and I was able to stand on the streets of a London being rebuilt. Not only that, I would be starting college, and handling my adult life just like those of my peers. "Everyone has good days and bad days," Dr. Bristol told me. I came to learn, though, that there are days that are neither good nor bad. There is a kind of day that is something else entirely. On those days, you are restless for something, and that fidgety feeling doesn't make your good days bad or your bad days good. It just makes you hungry. That was when I knew I had to move back to London to live, not just visit. It's time to get ready for the ballet. Love, Julia. June 24th, 1958. Dear Remy, the ballet was wonderful. Beautiful, actually. I had a surprisingly nice time meeting Simon's family. No one asked me about my own family, except to say things like, "So Simon tells me your grandfather is a professor of literature at Oxford." I cornered Simon and asked him what he had told everyone about me. He just said he told them I was lovely and smart, and that I lost my family in the war. You can say that, and it answers a thousand other questions. The war is still spoken of here as if it happened yesterday, even though it's been 13 years since VE Day. So instead of answering awkward questions about where was home for me and did I have any brothers and sisters, I answered questions about what it's like to be the granddaughter of an Oxford Don. Granny and Gramps had wanted me to go to college just like they wanted Neville to. I did try, Emmy. I tried to be the person they wanted me to be. But I found myself hungering for London. It was as if London were calling me to come back and become reacquainted with it again. There was unfinished business between London and me, and I needed to attend to it. My grandparents, especially Gramps, weren't happy about my wanting to leave college before I graduated, but they handled my decision better than they had handled my father's. They didn't cut me off, financially or personally, which is what they did to Neville. Sometimes you get a second chance in life. The thing was, as soon as I decided I needed to come back, I felt ready to come back. It was the strangest thing. It was 1953, and I had just turned 20, the same age you were when the war ended. I think that's why I had to come back then. I looked for you in the faces of the people I saw in the streets. I steeled my resolve, made a list of all the bridal shops, and I went to each one, looking for your name on the dresses or your face behind the counter. The first job I had was with the telephone company, which made it easy for me to look for your name in all the telephone exchanges in England, but I did not find you. Gramps helped me to get the job at Masters and Sons Cartographers. He went to school with Reginald Masters, the owner. I've been there for 3 years, and Simon for 2. We became friends, and then he asked me to dinner. He's never had a steady girlfriend before. He's a studious type. I have dated, but I can't say I've had a boyfriend. I've had boys date me, and boys dance with me, but I've never had a boy care for me like Simon does. As I got to know him better, I learned that he'd spent the war far from his parents, in a Suffolk farmhouse, cared for by foster parents, who hadn't a tenth of the affection for him and his brother that they had for their own children. If that were not hard enough, he was teased by the local children for the way he spoke, his city ways, and his bookish looks and behavior. When he returned to London after 5 years as an evacuee, he felt as displaced as I did when I came back to England. He isn't afraid to show his sensitive side, because it's really the only side he has. It took him forever to work up the courage to kiss me. I like that about him, Emmy. I like that the very thought of kissing me makes him tremble. He would marry me tomorrow if I said yes. He has told me 100 times he loves me. But I struggle to say this back to him, even though I think what I feel in my heart for him is love. And that's what scares me. I know what it is to have loved, to have a life that is uniquely yours, and to have people in it who are your sun and moon and stars. I know that feeling, and I dread how weak it makes us. Simon says love doesn't weaken us, it opens us. To love is not to be fragile, it is to be unlocked and open. And when something is open, other things can come in. And things can be taken out, I said to him. When you're standing there doing nothing remarkable, all you love can be yanked out of your open arms. What can be given in one moment can be taken in the next. Which is why I agreed to start seeing Dr. Diamon. After 5 years without professional counsel, this is why I must lay it all bare before another psychologist. I don't feel entitled to happiness, Emmy. I robbed you of yours. Dr. Diamon says the war is to blame for what came between you and me. I look around London, and I see all the new buildings. It's obvious that what the war did has been fixed. What I did is what I must fix. I want to fix what I broke. Julia. Chapter 38. June 27, 1958. Dear Remy, I am sitting here with a glass of sherry, watching the rain sputter against the living room window. It's late and I should be in bed, but I know that if I crawled under the covers, I would not be able to sleep. I have too much on my mind. I told Dr. Diamon today that I had written everything I could think of to tell you, and that I'm no closer to being able to say yes to a happy life than I was before I started. She asked what I thought was holding me back. I told her I had not been able to fix anything. Writing to you hasn't mended anything. I wanted to repair what I broke. If I could fix it, what would I do? She asked. You mean aside from going back in time? Yes. Well, if I knew where Aunt Charlotte's house was, maybe I would rap on the door and ask if I could have a peek in the crawl space of the bedroom to the right of the stairs. I said a kind of snippy, like I wasn't serious. And if you knew where Aunt Charlotte's house was, would you do that? A prickling sensation travelled up my spine as the hazy image I have of Aunt Charlotte materialized in my mind. Her grey braid, her smile with a little golden tooth at the back, and her blue car. She had chickens. She let me play with her dolls, two of them, and a tea set. Beyond those images was nothing but fog. But I don't remember where that house is, I said. Only that it's in Gloucestershire. Thea told Granny that Aunt Charlotte's house was in Gloucestershire, Emmy. Mum had told her that much. But then the prickling intensified. I suddenly remembered something else. Something that had been hidden in mist for nearly 20 years. Charlotte had a sister named Rose, I said. Dr. Diamon seemed cautiously surprised that I remembered this. She furrowed her brow. I could tell she was ruminating on something, wondering if what she was about to suggest was a good idea or not. "Have you ever considered looking for the house where you hid your sister's sketches?" she asked. I shook my head. I hadn't believed it was possible to find Aunt Charlotte's house. Then Dr. Diamon said that maybe if I retrieved the bride's box, if I unhid it, I would put to right a physical wrong. I could fix, to some extent, what I had broken. And if I could do that, then maybe I would find enough peace to believe that I do deserve to be happy. She told me to go home and think about what it might mean to me to have the bride's box again. Was the thought of finding it comforting to me, or frightening? Was I okay with the notion that I could very well find the house, but the box wouldn't be there? Could I handle earnestly looking for the house and not finding it? She told me not to rush to a decision either way. There was no wrong answer, she said. Just an A choice and B choice, like two doors painted the same color. What do you think I should do? I asked her. She thought for a moment. Then she said that I had written to you that more than anything, I wanted to undo what I did with the bride's box. Retrieving it wouldn't bring you back, but symbolically, I will have righted a wrong. A righted wrong only matters if you can unhurt the person you hurt, I told her. Yes, but what about your hurt, Julia? She said. This thing you did hurt you too. You believe you are undeserving of happiness because you robbed Emmy of hers. What am I supposed to do if I find it? I asked. I can't give the bride's box back to Emmy. She answered with this. What would you like to do with it? This is what is keeping me up tonight, Emmy. What would I do with your sketches if I could have them again? Simon told me at dinner tonight that he will help me if I decide to go looking for Aunt Charlotte's house. He has a car. We can use our Saturdays to drive out to Gloucestershire and poke about, which is surely the least effective way to look for it. But the evacuation records from my school were all lost to a demonic V1. Simon said if I want to do this, we could get a map of Gloucestershire from work and circle all the smaller cities that have train stations. We could check with the local officials of those towns to see if anyone knows of two sisters named Charlotte and Rose who took in evacuees from London at the start of the war. Simon asked me if I would know the house if I saw it. I told him I wasn't sure. Then he asked me if I truly wanted to try and find it. Because you don't have to do this, you know, he said. I could not answer him. And now as I sit here trying hard not to count raindrops on the window, I am not sure if I want to try. I think I'm sure that I want to find the bride's box. I'm just not sure that I want to try. It's the trying that scares me. I'm afraid this quest will be like the search to find the flat and the bridal shop. And you. I failed in all of those. But this I do know, Emmy. If I could find the bride's box, I would do for you what you wanted all along. If I can find your sketches, I will make the dream you had come true. Julia. July 2nd, 1958. Dear Emmy, I have decided to look for Aunt Charlotte's house. The more I've thought about it, the more I've come to believe it might actually be possible to find, so I can't imagine not trying. I asked Dr. Diamon what was the worst thing that could happen to me if I try to find the house and can't. She returned the question to me. What did I think the worst thing would be? I guess I would be no better or worse than I am now. She said if that was an accurate gauge of how I'd feel, she thought I should give it a go. So Simon and I got a map of Gloucestershire and spread it out on the lunch table at work. I remember that when you and I got off the train the day we left London, we walked outside and I saw that we weren't in a major city. It was more like a country town. The streets were not full of taxis and buses or tall buildings. I remember there being mums on the sidewalks with prams and a dead bird that you poked with your toe so that we could walk past it. Simon crossed off the larger cities like Gloucestershire, Cirencester, Cheltenham and Swindon. We drew circles around all the towns that would have had a train station in 1940. So many of the railway stations have closed since the war. Dozens in Gloucestershire alone, Emmy. People drive their own cars now. Anyway, as we were studying the map, I saw the word Cotswolds written in block letters, which is the name of one of Gloucestershire's districts, and I had another prickling feeling. I pulled the map closer to me and whispered that word out loud. The second I did, I saw us back in Aunt Charlotte's car, when she told us the golden-coloured stone we were seeing everywhere was Cotswold stone. Cotswolds, Emmy. I am right, aren't I? I turned to Simon and told him you and I were somewhere in the Cotswolds. Simon started naming towns. Adlestrop, Boughton-on-the-Water, Chipping Camden, Morton and Marsh, Stow-on-the-Wold, Fairford, Blockley, Naunton, The Slaughters, Oddington, Tewkesbury. But nothing sounded familiar to me. I must have started to look a little overwhelmed. Simon said to never mind, that I was brilliant because I had just narrowed the search